According to reports, Senate Democrats are expected to vote against the government's spending bill over DACA. That's the program that protects young undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children from deportation. We'll discuss the latest on the budget, immigration, and deportations with the Arizona Republic's Dennis Wagner and the Texas Tribune's Julian Aguilar. They both worked on an in-depth investigation, separate investigations, about the U.S.-Mexico border wall. What questions and comments do you have about how reporters cover these issues? Join us after the news.
Hello, I'm Marianne Marshall with the BBC News. The US Defense Secretary Jim Mattis has said the American military needs to focus more on gaining an advantage over major powers like China and Russia rather than fighting terrorism. Setting out his country's defense strategy, General Mattis warned that America's competitive edge had been eroded in every area of warfare. From New York, here's Neda Torfik.
The Defense Secretary, James Mattis, said the United States would prioritize fighting the growing threats from China and Russia. He described them as revisionist powers that aim to create a world based on an authoritarian model of government. The new National Defense Strategy is a shift from the United States' focus on fighting terrorism for more than a decade and a half. Instead, the focus will be on preparing for a major power war. Mr. Mattis called for more military funding, warning that America's competitive edge had been eroded in every area of warfare. Mr. Mattis said spending caps and short-term funding had done more harm to the readiness of the military than the United States' enemies.
The White House has accused Democrats of trying to force a U.S. government shutdown ahead of a last-minute Senate vote on a bill that would keep federal agencies running for another month. Gary O'Donoghue reports from Washington.
With the clock ticking, a shutdown looks increasingly likely. The parties are still far apart in the Senate, where Republicans need at least 10 Democratic votes, as things stand, to force the measure through. At issue, the Democrats' wish for a solution to the fate of the so-called Dreamers, almost 800,000 young people brought into the country illegally and whose status to work and study will be revoked in early March. While many Republicans support efforts to solve that problem, they want it tied to other provisions, such as President Trump's border wall and higher military spending.
The South Korean government says North Korea has cancelled plans to send an advance party to the South to inspect venues ahead of Pyongyang's expected participation in the Winter Olympics. Here's our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow.
The seven-strong team was due to travel on Saturday to prepare the way for the huge North Korean art troupe, which is due to accompany the athletes to South Korea for the Games. It's unclear why it's now not going. North Korea has not yet given a reason. It could be a small, easily solved issue, or a larger problem that could jeopardise plans for the North to take part in the Winter Olympics. Many had hoped that Pyongyang's participation would ease tension on the Korean Peninsula. They'll be disappointed if the North Koreans fail to turn up.
Reports from the Democratic Republic of Congo say at least 12 soldiers have been killed in the east of the country, where the army is fighting Ugandan Islamist rebels. A new military offensive was launched against rebels of the Allied Democratic Forces this month. You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. Pope Francis has triggered anger in Chile after accusing victims of a paedophile priest of slander. The Pope said there was no proof that Bishop Juan Barros had covered up abuse by Father Fernando Caradima, a priest whom the Vatican found guilty of abusing teenage boys over many years. The Pope made his comments in northern Chile on Thursday.
The day they bring me proof against Bishop Barros, then I will speak. There is not a single piece of evidence against him. Everything is slander. Is that clear?
One of the abuse victims said the comments were offensive and painful. 10 Syrian refugees have died of cold as they try to cross mountainous terrain on the border with Lebanon. The Lebanese Civil Defense Organization said the group was caught in a snowstorm. Most of the dead were women and children. Two Syrians, who were allegedly involved in trying to smuggle the refugees across the frontier, have been arrested. The Pakistani Interior Ministry has shut down Radio Free Europe's Pashto language service in Islamabad after the broadcaster was accused of airing programmes against the interests of Pakistan. The ministry also accused Radio Mashal of portraying Pakistan as a hub of terrorism and a safe haven for militant groups. Radio Mashal broadcasts in the country's northwest and in the tribal region bordering Afghanistan.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing media coverage of immigration. According to reports, Senate Democrats are expected to vote against the government's spending bill. At issue is DACA. That's the program that protects young undocumented immigrants who were brought to the United States as children from deportation. According to reports, even very moderate Democrats are expected to vote against that bill. And then in other immigration news, on Wednesday, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly told members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus that the U.S. would never build a wall along its entire southern border. He reportedly said the immigration promises Donald Trump made during the campaign were, quote, uninformed. Well, on Thursday, Trump pushed back on Twitter, saying Mexico will pay for the wall. That same day, Mexico said it would not pay for the wall. Rhetoric aside, large sections of the border already have a fence, security systems, and agents. It's also highly militarized. Joining us are two reporters who recently worked on in-depth investigations about the wall. Dennis Wagner is a senior reporter with the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network. Dennis Wagner and his colleagues flew, drove, and walked along the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border. Find their package of stories, interactive graphics, and documentaries. It's called The Wall, and it's at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Dennis. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much, Rose.
Thank you. We're also joined by Julian Aguilar. Julian is a reporter with the Texas Tribune, where he covers politics and border affairs from the Texas-Mexico border. Julian focuses on immigration reform and enforcement, and he worked with ProPublica reporters on a series of stories. One piece, The Taking, focuses on the government's boldest land grab in a generation, leaving a trail of abuse, mistakes, and unfairness. And you can also find those stories at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Julian. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Great to have both of you. Well, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, Dennis Wagner, let's start off with you. What caught your attention this week?
I was just flabbergasted to see President Trump's chief of staff announce that he had modified the president's view. As I think he used the word, he said the president's views on the border and the wall had evolved, and that as a result of that, his view of what was doable or what would be done had changed. And then I gather, from my understanding, the president then tweeted or said something basically backslapping that position, saying, no, my views haven't changed at all. So I don't know where we are on that.
What did you think about the coverage of this, just quickly, because John Kelly reportedly told the Congressional Hispanic Caucus that Trump is just, he made promises during the campaign, but those promises were uninformed.
Right. I would have something to make of it if Trump hadn't come out afterward and said, those statements just are not true. So I'm not sure what to make of it. I mean, I also understand, I think we all understand, to some extent, presidential or other candidate statements during a campaign are less informed than they should be and sometimes more exaggerated than they should be. But still, it just came across as bizarre how the chief of staff and the president didn't seem to be on the same page.
Julian, what did you make of that?
I agree. I think Secretary Kelly or the former DHS secretary, I guess, he's considered one of the most steady hands in the administration, where others, obviously, we saw what happened with former Advisor Bannon and just the civil war that can happen within the president's inner circle. But for former Secretary Kelly to say this and to actually sort of kind of add to the misinformation or the confusion that everybody seems to associate with the Trump campaign and what he's been told and who informs them, was pretty, for lack of a better term, staggering. And then especially because he chose to meet with the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. But this entire fight is very, I think, fascinating. And somewhat related, I guess, on a positive note, I think, depending on who you ask, the cover of the Time magazine's The Avengers, featuring all the women that are running in office as a response to either the president or just to politics as usual that they see, I thought was an enlightening piece, because it actually shows sort of the power of information, what can lead people to do. Again, not completely related to immigration, but you asked, you know, what positive news article we saw over the last week, and I think that was probably the one that stuck out more than the other.
We did a show about the resistance a couple days ago, and time is already flying, and I got my dates wrong. And so you brought up the Time magazine cover story about women running for office, and the Women's March is actually happening across the country tomorrow. They're happening in cities across the country. We will find those stories and put links at yourcallradio.org. Dennis Wagner is senior reporter for the Arizona Republic and USA Today, and Julian Aguilar is a reporter with the Texas Tribune, where he covers border issues. I also wanted to ask both of you, before we get into your investigations, about what's happening right now. According to reports, Senate Democrats are expected to vote against the government's spending bill. And Vox is reporting that even moderate conservative Democrats are expected to vote against the bill. At issue is DACA, the program that protects 700,000 undocumented immigrants who were brought here as children. Julian, I know that you're following this like we are on Twitter, but what do you make of this, Senate Democrats voting against this bill over DACA?
Well, I just think they are standing up to, first, the president and trying to see exactly where he is on the issue. I mean, the president's position on specifically DACA, he hasn't wavered so much on more boots on the ground technology and the wall, but with DACA, you know, his mood seems to change like the weather in Texas, or, you know, a 20-minute jazz solo. You never know where it's going to go from one day to the next or 1 minute to the next. So I think the Democrats are trying to call out the president and say, give us an exact idea of where you are. But I think, you know, politics aside, is that this is another sort of issue where the Dreamers, like you mentioned, 700,000, I've seen estimates of 750, almost 800,000 across the country, including 124,000 here in Texas. California has more, and as my colleague in Arizona on the line probably knows, that this is going to affect a bunch of people there. You know, these are kids, now young adults, that with every single morning are watching what's going on with the news, and they really have no idea what to plan for, how to plan, whether they should, you know, prepare to go back. So I think this is hanging in the balance, and I think that's what Democrats, no matter how, I guess, well-intended they might be, I don't know if they realize the anxiety this is causing, because, and the immigrant community is some of the best, it's one of the most organized that I've ever seen with respect to sit-ins and rallies and just, you know, getting emails out and just, you know, saturating their opinion out there and to try to get movement and support for their cause. And they're even saying, you know, the Democrats, some of them are playing with Dreamers' lives just as much as the Republicans are. Mm-hmm. So I think the Democrats, they're well-intended, but this could backfire on both sides, I think.
You make a good point, because last year, Dreamers, immigrant rights activists, were so angry at Democrats. They would go to different rallies and, you know, put up signs and yell and say, you've got to deal with this issue. So why do you think that Democrats, Senate Democrats, even moderates, are going to vote against this bill over DACA?
I think because they still have a little bit of time. I think because the March 5th deadline, you know, is still about a month and a half out. And I think maybe, you know, if the DACA was going to expire or start to expire, this will roll out maybe within the next week. This might be a different conversation. So that we saw this last month before they took a break for the holiday, that, you know, the Dreamers wanted something before the holiday, but they passed the stopgap spending bill, and the Dreamers were upset then, so maybe they thought, okay, we're going to get something in January. Now, like you said, this is changing as we just have this discussion. Every minute something else is coming up, and now there's talk about a five-day spending bill to try to hash out a deal. But, you know, I just think that maybe that's what it is. If DACA was going to end next week, then they'd hold firm. But if they have until March 5th, maybe they're thinking, okay, well, we're going to get the president and the Republicans to do something temporarily so we can have some more negotiation. I don't think it's an all-or-nothing situation right now, but I think with these dreamers, every single day they want something at the end of the day to make them sleep a little bit better at night. But as of right now, you know, 12:15 Central Standard Time in Texas, it doesn't seem like that's going to happen before midnight tonight.
Right. Dennis, do you have anything to add? I know you don't cover DACA specifically.
A couple of things briefly. You know, the president, I believe the president also said he wouldn't sign a spending bill unless, or a budget, unless it contains funding for the wall. That's still to be seen. And Julian mentioned something. He mentioned that the president's perception of the wall and border security hasn't changed, but one element of it has, and that is the wall itself has been a completely moving goalpost. He's at one point talked about a 2,000-mile wall that was 20 to 40 feet tall, and then the size of the wall has changed, and now it's a transparent wall instead of a thick concrete wall. The cost of the wall has just, the projected costs have been all over the board, so everything's a moving target there.
Dennis Wagner is senior reporter for the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network. Dennis and his colleagues flew, drove, and walked along the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border. Julian Aguilar is a reporter with the Texas Tribune, and he worked with ProPublica reporters on a series of stories about the wall. They're in-depth investigative pieces with lots of really incredible graphics, documentaries, in-depth reporting. You can find them at yourcallradio.org. Julian, when you and your colleagues decided to take on this project, I mean, this is a huge topic. What specifically were your goals?
Well, our goals started off very generally, and before I start, I'd like to give credit to Kia Collier, my colleague at the Texas Tribune, and T. Christian Miller at ProPublica. I mean, the ProPublica was great to work with, and you learned. I've been doing this for 12 years, and I still learn something every single day that I work with T and the folks at ProPublica. And Kia is just one of the hardest working reporters that I've ever met. And so we went to a barbecue joint. We sat around talking about the wall and how this is going to be a big issue. And we started off in very, very general terms. And when we started narrowing it down to where we could focus on environmental issues or on the costs, the folks at ProPublica did a lot of research on the court cases, the eminent domain court cases that arose from the 2006 Secure Fence Act, and we poured through hundreds of cases, and we found that several were still pending. But I think the thing that stuck out and what we focused on was the fact that if you lived on one tract of land, the government came and made an offer, and some people took that offer, whereas their neighbors were maybe able to hire an attorney, and they got up to 10 times more than their neighbor did for the same size of land. And just the discrepancies, we concentrated in the first part on a four-mile stretch in Cameron County in Brownsville called Oklahoma Avenue. And the stories that you would hear from one blog to the next as far as when the landmen came, what the process was, how much they got paid, to another, you know, to the far end where the stories were completely different was just fascinating because it just showed, even under George W. Bush and continued with the presidency of Barack Obama, how haphazard and inconsistent this process was. And we sought out to not only tell people that story, but also to let them know what they could do, because unlike other border states, the majority of land on the Texas border is privately owned. Mm. And these aren't folks, some of them are very, very wealthy, but most of them are very hardworking blue-collar folks that save whatever they could to eventually be able to retire or to grow crops or just to move out into the suburbs on this land. And now the fact that that might be taken away from them yet again, we thought that they should be armed with knowledge to see exactly what they could do to fight back to get a fair price for land that they worked so hard to buy.
And this was incredible. The Texas Tribune, where you work, and your colleagues at ProPublica looked at 197 cases in the Rio Grande Valley where the government took possession of property from landowners. And you report that so many landowners were almost powerless to stop the process.
Right, because eminent domain. I mean, these are mechanisms that were put into place, and we're talking about, you know, circumventing environmental regulations to be able to build this land. We were talking about, you know, people. Literally, some people just got a knock on the door with a uniformed Border Patrol agent wearing the standard green uniform, and a person they described as, you know, wearing a white shirt and a tie that was from the Army Corps of Engineers, with a letter saying, "We're from the Department of Homeland Security. We're working with the Army Corps of Engineers. We need this land because, you know, this is where we're going to build something." And you know, from looking at what happened in Washington with emails and satellite pictures where they thought the fence could be, then they realized that they couldn't. I mean, there were examples of some cases where private landowners were paid for land that they didn't even own. It was their neighbors, or it was the city of Brownsville's, or the city of Brownsville was paid for private land, and it was just a big back and forth. And, you know, to be fair to the government, there was a handful of U.S. Government attorneys that were working on all these cases, so they were overwhelmed as well. But you're exactly right. Some people that we talked to, again, we talked to one guy, one gentleman, Mehmet Flores, who was a welder. He did sheet metal work, and he said, you know, the government comes in and they tell you that they're going to do this. They tell you that you can't fight them back. And at the end of the day, what are you going to do? And some people said, if I hire an attorney, I'm going to spend just as much money on an attorney as I am, as the same amount that they're going to pay me for this land. So it's better to get something instead of zero out at the end.
Hey, Rose, can I just interject something
to
add to that? We also looked at some of those issues in Texas as part of our story, and there were 320 condemnations as part of this Cure Feds Act in Texas. And 9 years later, 85 of those cases are still in court. They haven't even been resolved legally. And already tens and hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent. We also then calculated how many properties would be implicated in Texas by a border wall if it went the whole 1,200 miles or so along the Rio Grande. And it would be 5,000 properties that theoretically would have to face some sort of condemnation action or buyout. So just that segment of a wall project, if you built a wall along the entire Texas border with the Mexico, it's just amazing what you'd be up against.
And for people who live in Northern California, I mean, if we haven't been to the border to see this wall, it's just amazing when you read these pieces, because as you both report, Dennis, in the USA Today piece, you report that farmers are cut off from their farms, neighbors are cut off from their neighbors. I mean, you have to really see the photos and the videos to get a really good overall sense of how this works.
And let me just mention that our videotaping, we videotaped the entire border, and you can go on a map and click wherever you want to see what it looks like from a helicopter, what fencing is there or in most cases is not there. So you can really get an impression of anywhere along the U.S.-Mexico border that you want by looking at the videotape if you go to our website.
And Dennis, what did you and your colleagues at the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network want to really focus on when you took on this project?
My bosses started talking about, you know, there's the wall became probably the symbolic issue of the Trump campaign. He's elected president. My bosses say, we need to look at the border and look at the wall and try to figure out exactly what we're talking about here. What is there? What is the landscape? What would it cost? All those kinds of things. And so they first started talking about driving the border, and the reporters who have covered the border, including me, said, that's just not possible. Most of the border isn't accessible to a vehicle, and even where it is, you're talking about really bad four-wheel drive roads for along most of it. We just cannot access the border that way. And so then they started talking about, well, maybe we should get a helicopter, and that's what we did. And so we drove the wall where we could get to it on foot in places we did, but most importantly, we flew it with a helicopter that had a nose camera so that it was videotaping every inch of the way, and then we wrote like 15 or 20 stories about it, did all kinds of other stuff.
That is Dennis Wagner, senior reporter for the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network. Dennis and his colleagues, as he just said, flew, drove, and walked along the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border. Find their package of stories, The Wall, at yourcallradio.org. Julian Aguilar is a reporter with the Texas Tribune. Julian and his colleagues at the Texas Tribune and ProPublica worked on a series of in-depth pieces about the wall. The taking focuses on the government's land grab, leaving a trail of abuse, mistakes, and unfairness. You know, you make a good point, Dennis, about how Trump just talked about the wall nonstop during his campaign and made so many racist remarks about rapists and drug dealers. And I just wonder, as reporters, because those comments were repeated over and over again from TV to radio, how do you think the administration changed the perception and people's understanding of those who endure so much to get into this country?
Boy, I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that. I mean, because I think that that is so unique to every individual who is listening to a president or a candidate or talking about these things. I mean, there were plenty of people in Arizona and every other state who shared the president's views on these things. And if you go down to southern Arizona or even in Phoenix, I mean, we had Sheriff Joe Arpaio who got elected over and over again because he was rounding up illegal aliens. And we had Senate Bill 1070, a law that was probably the most stringent anti-immigration law in the nation. So I think there were a lot of people that shared that view, and he tapped into that. But I also think it influenced public perceptions of the border and illegal immigrations and the issues. So I think it's pretty complex, though.
Julian, what are your thoughts?
No, I agree. I'd definitely be hesitant to speak to the millions of Texas on how they were affected individually. But stepping back, I think it was just said about Arizona's SB 1070 is similar to what we have with Texas's Senate Bill 4, which was finally passed. And there's some exact truth to the fact that Trump and his rhetoric did resonate with people, because the Texas legislature, along a party line vote, passed SB 4. It's tied up with the Fifth Circuit right now on what can be enforced and what can't be enforced. But some folks would even say that it's even more strict than their Arizona's SB 1070 with the quote-unquote papers please provision, where it doesn't require that police officers ask, but what it does is it prohibits the police chief from telling his or her officers you can't ask about status. So it's up to the individual officer. But unlike other bills, they have to have reasonable suspicion that the person is in the country illegally, whereas SB 4 gives no such guidance. So it did fall on a lot of supportive ears, and even some Texas Republicans that were reluctant of a President Trump have now, a year later, sort of fallen into line with his rhetoric. And you had people that were running for office that were Republicans saying immigration is complex and immigration makes Texas great and makes this country great, and now they're a year later they're saying, no, we need to stop chain migration, no, the diversity system is completely flawed, no, we need to limit this, we need to, you know, they're going along with what the president has said over the last 10 to 12 months. And I don't think, with respect to the White House trying to push this agenda, I don't think that's changed. We saw what happened with El Salvador, and when DHS officials were remarking about taking away the TPS, temporary protective status, there were some reporters that were saying, this is still a violent country, why are you sending these people back? And they said, well, no, the TPS was because of the earthquakes, and we didn't take the violence into consideration. Mm. And when you step back, and they wouldn't address the fact that the Civil War caused a lot of this violence, they wouldn't, that the U.S., you know, back to the conservative elements there, they wouldn't address the fact that MS-13 and the 18th Street Gang honed their tactics in California prisons and then were exported back during the Clinton administration. So I think a lot of these folks, I think the Trump is definitely keeping with his message. And we saw just in the last couple of days where his spokesperson said, ask people in El Paso, Texas, what they think about the wall, because it's one of the safest cities. And there was just an enormous pushback against those statements, because El Paso has been safe since before the fence went up. And, you know, unlike other places, some people say, you know, the wall's not a big deal here because it's a desert. The Rio Grande there is a trickle. You could throw a rock across it on any good day, because it's a concrete channel as opposed to a wide ranging river the way it is in Laredo or Brownsville or other places. So to my colleague's point, he's very, very correct in the fact that some people were offended, a lot of people were offended, but a lot of people said, hey, man, this guy, he's speaking the truth, and we feel the same way.
Julian Aguilar is a reporter with the Texas Tribune. Dennis Wagner is senior reporter for the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network. They both worked on major in-depth investigations about the wall. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. ¶¶
are listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KLW. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255, a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org. Or tweet us at yourcallradio. On Fridays, it's 2 hours of 1A from WAMU in Washington. That'll be from 11 to 1 here on KLW. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday's Your Call One Planet series, we will speak with Penn State professor and climatologist Michael Mann, who says the Trump administration is the most anti-science and anti-environmental administration in history. We'll speak with him about how scientists are responding to the attack on science. He'll also give us the latest on climate change and extreme weather. And then Tuesday, I hope you can join us, we're going to mark the 45th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision by speaking with a panel of women who remember what life was like before abortion was legal, including a nurse. That is on Tuesday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests about media coverage of immigration and the border wall, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by Julian Aguilar. He's a reporter with the Texas Tribune. He and his colleagues at the Texas Tribune and ProPublica worked on in-depth investigations about the wall. You can find them at yourcallradio.org. Dennis Wagner is a senior reporter for the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network. Dennis and his colleagues flew, drove, and walked along the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border. You know, Dennis, what an amazing trip. I mean, to meet people, to see the landscape. What really stood out for you when you flew, drove, and walked along the border?
Well, I think a whole bunch of things. One of the big takeaways was just trying to figure out what security exists there, and it already. And we've got 654 miles of fencing, but 300 miles of that is just vehicle barriers. So what exists is 354 miles of pedestrian fencing. It's like mostly 12-foot, some of it's 18-foot fencing. So there's just not a lot there. But then you start to understand one of the reasons for that is just the landscape. And when I talk about that, I knew it was pretty cool landscape on the border, but I hadn't seen a lot of it. When you see it from the air, it's just this magnificent, severe, often treacherous, really diverse topography and countryside. We're talking mountain peaks over 6,000 feet, river canyons with cliffs that are 1,200, 1,500 feet deep, desert flats and dead volcanoes and sand dunes and all this different country. And a lot of that country, by the way, is a natural barrier that makes a wall look ridiculous. Mm. Because when you're talking about putting a wall next to a river canyon that's got 1,200-foot or so cliffs, it just doesn't seem to make any sense. So that was a huge takeaway. The whole issue with the seizures of land in the Rio Grande River Valley were just we've already talked about it, but that was unbelievable. And I think maybe as much as anything, I kept thinking about how we were going to see all these illegal immigrants and smugglers and stuff. We flew 2,000 miles, 10 days of flying and driving the border. We did not see a single person who we would have considered a suspected illegal border crosser during that time. We didn't see anybody that would look to be smuggling anything during that time. We saw no one apprehended by the Border Patrol. And when you think about it, it kind of made sense, partly because we were flying in the daytime in the summer, so there's not as many people out, but also because the rate of illegal immigration has plummeted in 2000. It's the lowest it's been in 40 years. So in 2000, there were 1.7 million Border Patrol apprehensions in the Southwest. In 2017, there are around 300,000. It's just the scale of the problem has changed dramatically, and I don't think that the public consciousness of that has matched the change.
Julian, the numbers are down, but people are still risking their lives to cross the border.
They sure are. Oh, you were talking to Julian. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I mean, if you have something to add, please feel free. I mean, Arizona is ground zero for migrant
deaths. I was just going to say, there's plenty of border crossers have died in the Rio Grande River Valley and that area, but flying over some of the remote Sonoran Desert of Arizona, where it's just mile after mile of rugged landscape, searing temperatures, no water, and you know there are skeletons down there because I've walked down there and I've found skeletons down there. You, from the air and from the ground, you get an appreciation for what kind of motivation must be there for someone to risk their lives going on that kind of adventure. And I think that's the point you're trying to get to.
Well, you and your colleagues interviewed a young man who was just talking about basic necessities, and he said, if death doesn't stop us, will a wall?
Sure. And we also, one of our reporters and a videographer went out with a woman looking for her brother out there, and it was just heartbreaking to see somebody searching through miles of endless expanse of desert looking for a needle in a haystack, so to speak.
Julian, what would you add about people who are still taking these risks to cross the border?
Oh, I mean, it's definitely happening. I spoke at an event last week during MLK weekend on immigration, and I just rattled off three press releases that I got from the sector chief in the Rio Grande Valley with respect to 22 migrants found in a tractor trailer. And obviously everybody knows what happens in the summer with these folks when they get trapped in there. We just saw a horrible case in San Antonio a few months back, but some of them also freeze to death, and especially in these extreme temperatures that the entire Southwest is experiencing. But so these three press releases, I think one talked about skeletal remains found in ranches near Falfurrias, and Falfurrias is in Brooks County, which isn't directly on the border, but it's the first checkpoint, Border Patrol checkpoint, that you get to when you're coming up Highway 281 from the Rio Grande Valley. So they really do go. It's just such a desperate situation. And separate from the taking project, my colleague Jay Root and I went to El Salvador in 2015 and 2016. In 2016 to talk to people there. And as Dennis said, I mean, he's exactly right with respect to with the people that you talk to that have been caught and sent back, and their determination, you know, come hell or high water, to get to the United States. Because, you know, I reported in Nuevo Laredo and Ciudad Juarez during the height of those drug wars there, and what the fear that I experienced as a reporter in San Salvador, I was above and beyond that, because it's a place that's, you know, still it competes with Honduras for the most violent city the most violent country in the Americas, depending on which given year it is. But just the determination, and I think you get people that don't understand that and say, you know, how can a mother let her 12-year-old kid go on a bus or on top of a train to get to the United States all alone and, you know, send them on that dangerous path? Well, because the option to keep them at home is even worse. And one thing with respect to the people that we saw on the border during this project, and even people in Texas, I just think it still astounds me that people don't really know the geography of the border, and they don't realize that you can't build this wall or a fence right on the banks of the river because of weak soil, because of treaties, because just the fact that it's not possible. So the fence would have to come inland. You know, in El Paso, it's maybe 5 or 6 yards. In the Rio Grande Valley, it's a half a mile up. So that affects the people that live not on the banks of the river, but even, you know, even a mile inland. And I don't think people realize that they're outside of the border states, because they think they can look at a map and draw a line and say, why can't we just build it here? It's
right.
Pretty easy to meet.
Yeah, it's so true. And I mean, in both of your pieces, you write about families who've been, you know, owned farms for many generations, and, you know, low income families who have nowhere else to go. I mean, Julian, can you talk about how this is really affecting people's lives? I mean, we're not just talking about a wall here. We're talking about people's lives.
Well, we spoke to one gentleman. His name is Ray Loop, and he and his family And he's been in the news a lot. I don't know if Dennis came across some of the family members here, but he has a story where his house was, they had a two-story house, and they lived in the upstairs and downstairs, and it was actually south of the wall, and it caught fire, and they couldn't get to it because of the fence, because of the wall, and he literally had to stand there and hear his dogs that rushed in to help him evacuate his family burn up to death, and it's a horrible situation. And we talked to another guy, Juan Cavazos, who's a retired school teacher. They probably had, I forget the number, I don't have the story in front of me, but he had several acres that were south of the river, south of the border fence on the levee, and he said that he can't farm that anymore, and it's useless to him, and he can't sell it because who is going to buy land that's now south of the fence that they can't gain easy access to? And I think one of the most striking things that we saw were the gaps. There are some places where the fence goes on for miles and then it just stops. And in some places, those gaps, they have a fence that open and close. So when they close, obviously it's a continuous fence. But there are some gaps that there is no gate that goes back and forth. It's just a big gap. And the government has said during the Bush and Obama years that was to lure people to those gaps so they could concentrate on this area. But if the resources are so low, as the government says, then what's to stop these people from coming into the gaps? I mean, what's the point of having a canoe with holes in it?
Your pieces also point out, Dennis, your piece points out that fencing was easier to build in New Mexico, Arizona, and California, where the federal government controls a 60-foot wide strip of land adjacent to the border, but not so easy in Texas because of treaty provisions and private property rights.
Right. Yeah. And I wanted to go back to that human issue that you mentioned, because there are human issues all over the place. We talked about the illegal immigrants who are willing to risk their lives, and he just talked about the people in the Rio Grande who are blocked out of their own property. There's also in southern Arizona, we've got ranchers who have illegal immigrants and criminal aliens who are coming across smuggling, rampaging through their property, tearing out fences, breaking into buildings, and scaring them. Frankly, there's all kinds of human stories in this thing, and I think part of our whole ambition when we took on this project was to try to look at those, but also bring into picture a fact-based study of a wall idea. And one of the things that just blew my mind is everywhere I looked, there is no cost-benefit analysis that has been done by the Border Patrol, by Homeland Security, by the White House. So nobody has evaluated what it would cost per mile, where the wall should be built. And I think that's what we were hoping Americans would take away from this and maybe decide, let's not look at this as just a knee-jerk political controversy. Let's take a fact-based look at realistically what should be done. Should it be built, and what locations, and what are the costs, who's going to pay for it, that kind of stuff. And so far, we still really haven't gotten to that point, I don't think.
And out of 2,000 miles, 650 miles of the border are currently fenced. Is that right, Dennis?
That's right, and only 354 of that are fenced to stop pedestrians. The others are just to stop vehicles from cutting through. There's a stretch in Texas, 600 miles, the no country for old men kind of part of West Texas. 600 miles, there's not a single fence.
What were the major differences between the Bush administration and the Obama administration on the wall? Julian,
you want to take that on?
I just think, in our reporting, we found obviously the Bush administration was who signed the Secure Fence Act, and what we saw that a lot of why the process was so haphazard was because we spoke to an advisor for former Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison that said, who at the time was the senior senator from Texas, and this person said they had a deadline there that it was should be completed before 2008. For the end of 2008, because the Bush administration wanted to say we've accomplished something. So I think with respect to that administration, obviously it started the process. It was under this administration that started the land condemnation, but it was also, I think, that administration is to blame for how haphazard it was, because they had some end goal in sight so they could have something accomplished by the end of his second term. With respect to the president, with President Obama, I guess he had a lesser role, but he did continue these practices, and he used Bush administration policies in order to get whatever the land that they needed to get that still hadn't been acquired. So I think those are the two main differences. And if I could just go back and add about the human element, and Dennis is exactly right. We also, not in the taking, but in the bordering on insecurity project, it is important to highlight the families whose sons or daughters have been killed by people in the country illegally. And it is important, I think, to highlight the fact that some of these folks were let out of jail only to return. And we tried our best to do that. We're, you know, I guess if you're a reporter and you're upsetting people on both sides of the aisle, then you're probably doing your job well. But it's not a simple black and white issue. It's very nuanced. And aside from being jealous of the fact that Dennis got to ride in a helicopter, I will say that I appreciate him, you know, highlighting that point, because there are some people that are for the security, and there are some people that say, hey, you know, just like their land got seized, and that sucks for them. I have 200 acres here, and I worked hard for it, and I don't like it being traversed by people in the country illegally and breaking windows or breaking in or threatening my wife or my children or even, you know, or my own life, because they're either hungry or they're looking to rob me. So,
I can add to the difference between the Bush and the Obama administration in one respect, and that is Bush's administration, the real American backlash against immigration evolved during the Bush administration, and the remedy that Congress and the president went for was to build a fence. And so that's when most of today's border fence was built, as a result of the 2006 Fence Act. Obama got in office, and the public outrage that was there, it accelerated in part because Republicans saw it as a weapon that they could use against Democrats. And so the Obama administration was, in many respects, on the defensive and reactive, and they weren't building fence. Instead, they did a ton of things. They doubled the size of the Border Patrol, and they invested a huge amount in technology. We're talking about sensors, cameras, lights, all the different what they call border security infrastructure that now backs up whatever fencing exists along the forward and helps Border Patrol agents to do their job. This is ground sensors, it's cameras, it's all kinds of stuff.
Dennis Wagner is senior reporter for the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network. Dennis and his colleagues from the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network flew, drove, and walked along the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border. Julian Aguilar is a reporter with the Texas Tribune. Julian and his colleagues with the Texas Tribune and ProPublica worked on a series of stories about the wall, and you can find both at yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions or comments for our guests about the wall and reporting on these issues, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. I wanted to ask you about a video that's going around, and Julian, you have this on Twitter also. There's a video of Border Patrol agents kicking, slashing, and dumping plastic gallon containers of water that a number of humanitarian organizations leave for migrants trekking through the desert. And No More Deaths had a couple of big reports this week about how Border Patrol agents treat immigrants. What are your thoughts on this? Because it's getting a lot of attention.
Right, I did see that. And I saw the story from The Guardian, before I saw the videos, I think there was another outlet that posted those videos. And what I tweeted is it's very, very disturbing. And you see, we've seen evidence of that happening in the Rio Grande Valley as well. There are some landowners that fly a homemade sign with the Red Cross emblem, and that's tethered to a drum of water. And we've heard that some people, we thought they were vigilantes. We have no evidence to prove that it's Border Patrol agents, but they dump those out. And I just think, I personally think it's very, very, it's very cruel. Again, landowners, including my grandfather, who had land on the Texas-Mexico border, they've been known since as long as I can remember to leave jugs of water out because they know that the trek these people make. But I said it was a disturbing report, but I also tried to qualify that with the fact that when we rode along with the Rio Grande Valley agents several times, in the back of their Border Patrol units, they had the bottles of water in 24 packs that you would get at Sam's or at Walmart, and they would hand these out to undocumented folks that they came across. Obviously, they would process them and take them into custody, but the first thing they said is, "Are you okay?" do you need any water? And just, I know people that I went to high school with in El Paso who are Border Patrol agents, and I've had a few agents tell me, like, man, I give them sandwiches and gallons of water before. I've done that more times than I've drawn my weapon. But because it is a fourth, at least on the southwest border, of, you know, 20,000 agents, you can't paint everybody with a broad brush. But those videos were very hard to watch. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they were celebrating, the fact that they were dumping out water that could be used by somebody that has made this trek and would likely, there's a good chance that person would say, I'm done with it, and would surrender to the Border Patrol. It wasn't like they were leaving boxes of ammunition or weapons out for these people to use and pick up and use against the agents. I mean, this is water. Mm. It was tough to watch, but like I said, it's not, you can't paint every agent with that broader brush.
According to the No More Deaths report, from 2012 to 2015, groups have placed more than 31,000 gallons of water at 139 aid stations on trails along the border. And by the group's measure, 86% of that water was used, proving that they really need water. About 10% of the stashed water was destroyed during that period. That's about 3,500 gallons. Dennis, do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, I agree with Julian that there are tons of really compassionate Border Patrol agents. I'm not sure how many agents have been shown in these videos, and I don't think they, I hope they don't reflect consensus or even a large number of other Border Patrol agents agreeing with. But I think this issue, it kind of reflects one of the most vexing problems, and I don't know how to resolve it with the whole controversy, and that is the best fencing, the most useful fencing, is around cities and towns, urban areas, because in those locations supported by agents and other technology, that's where it's easiest for people to cross over, and to secure the border, you have to put up fencing in those locations. And the more fencing you put around urban areas and the farther it goes out into the outback, the more it forces illegal immigrants who are going to cross anyway to go into places that are just treacherous, that are just hell. And so the reason that we've seen deaths escalate over the years is because they've had to go, and it's been part of a Border Patrol policy and kind of an understandable policy on the security side, but on the humanitarian side, it's subject to huge criticism. The idea is force them into the most bleak, dangerous places because that might reduce the number of people trying to cross.
Mm. Well, let's end on a humanitarian note. We have an email from Michael who says, why is there little or no discussion of the fact that those crossing the border without authorization are, for the most part, refugees from exploitation by U.S. corporations with federal backing going back to the McKinley administration? Julian, you made a couple points earlier about how, you know, it's rare to get historical context in these pieces. You hear about the wall on the cable shows, you see footage of people trying to, you know, climb over it or people on the side of it looking at each other. What about the human element of this story with all of this attention on the wall? And also to talk about why people know that there's a possibility in the case of women, they can be sexually assaulted and raped, and men and women could die if they take this journey.
No, I think the listener who emailed is exactly right, and we could talk about U.S. foreign policy influencing Latin America. I mean, we could spend a day alone talking about Guatemala in the 50s and how that radicalized people like Che Guevara and what they saw as, you know, the imperialist Yankee, you know, and its effect on these Latin American countries. But like I mentioned earlier, I think the on the ground impact that we saw most directly was when we did our Boarding on Integrity project in El Salvador. I mean, you have the police chief, the head of Chief Cotto, who is the head of the Policía Nacional Civil, there was a rebel fighter that used to fight against the Americans during the Civil War and now is getting aid, receiving aid from the Obama administration. I mean, there are statues to the revolutionary movement that are across the street from a Denny's and a Quiznos. And I think you saw that the president of, or the Mexican administration yesterday, the day before yesterday, pushed back heavily against criticisms about the Trump administration saying Mexico is the deadliest country in the world. And they said, hey, you know, we have our issues, but look at your gun policy and look at your demand for drugs. So again, like the listener who emailed that, he's right on U.S. foreign influence, but If you say that, then you're labeled as not patriotic instead of an intellectual that wants to balance out both sides, especially in this day and age where it just becomes so heated. Not to say that that story doesn't come up, and I think journalists across the borderlines have also written about that, but he's right in the fact that the human aspect does get lost, and it's partially the fact because of the fact that when somebody comes across, if it's 1 out of 10 people that come across without authorization that commit the crime, those are the stories that get told. You know, the immigrant community says, you know, 90% of the immigrants that come over are fleeing violence and poverty, and they just want to work hard, and that's absolutely true. But you know, to balance it out, we also have to report on the fact that some of these people do things that aren't welcomed into the United States, and I think that's where the balance is. But with respect to foreign policy, that's so convoluted, it's just one facet, but I do agree that it's a story that needs to be told.
Dennis, we have about a minute left. What would you add?
I think that Julian handled that pretty well, and I'll let it go.
What are you both working on right now? Dennis, what are you working on?
I'm working on stories related to the whole Me Too controversy. I'm not even covering border issues right now.
What about Me Too?
Sexual harassment cases.
In Arizona?
I mean, this whole phenomenon has spurred many women who were victims or who believe they were victims, depending on who's talking, I suppose, but to come forward. So I think every newspaper and other news outlet in the country has been flooded with tips that you have to pursue, find out if there's legitimacy and whether you can do a story or not. A lot of times it's a he said, she said, so they're really difficult stories to tell.
Does this have to do with politicians in Arizona?
It's politicians, it's entertainers, it's people in the sports industry, it's people in other industries and government agencies, all of the above.
Wow. Well, thank you for covering that. What about you, Julian? What are you working on?
Well, right now, it's election season we're in election season. The primaries in Texas, at least, are right around the corner. So we're busy covering state house races, and sort of there's a battle between moderate Republicans and far-right Republicans in primaries, and there's also Democrats that want to get a foothold in Texas politics because they've had a drought since the mid-90s as far as a statewide candidate, and also the elections in Mexico. I'm based in El Paso, and NAFTA is huge for Laredo, El Paso, Houston, Port Arthur, so four of the largest trading hubs in the country are in Texas, and they have a populist candidate right now who's leading in the polls who could affect the relationship between the United States and Mexico as much as President Trump affected that relationship last year.
Wow, that's important. Well, Julian Aguilar is a reporter with the Texas Tribune. Dennis Wagner is a senior reporter for the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network, and they both worked with their colleagues on in-depth investigations about the U.S.-Mexico border wall. Julian and Dennis, thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you back. Thanks for your reporting.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Coming up on Monday's Your Call One Planet series, we'll be speaking with climatologist Michael Mann about the Trump administration's war on science. We'll find out how scientists are fighting back. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. If you missed any of our past shows this week, we marked MLK Day by talking about environmental justice with Mustafa Ali. We also spoke with Daniel Ellsberg, who released the Pentagon Papers about his new book, The Doomsday Machine. We talked about the resistance, and we had on Father Greg Boyle, who founded Homeboy Industries. You can find those shows at yourcallradio.org, and be sure to sign up for our podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Lauren Schechter is our social media producer. David Latulipe is our studio engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.